This is Family Policy Matters. This program is produced by the North Carolina Family Policy Council, a pro-family research and education organization dedicated to strengthening and preserving the family. And now from the studio, here's John Rustin, president of the North Carolina Family Policy Council.
Thank you for joining us this week for Family Policy Matters. It is our pleasure to have Dr. Kevin Sabet with us on the program. Dr. Sabet is the director of the Drug Policy Institute at the University of Florida and the co-founder of Project SAM, or Smart Approaches to Marijuana. From 2009 to 2011, he served as senior advisor at the White House Office of National Drug Control Policy under the Obama administration. Prior to this, he served as a drug policy advisor to both Presidents George W. Bush and Bill Clinton. He blogs regularly at the Huffington Post and has been featured on the front page of the New York Times and virtually every major media publication and news channel on the subject of drug policy. Dr. Sabet is with us to talk about his recent book, Reefer Sanity, Seven Great Myths About Marijuana. Dr. Sabet, thanks so much for joining us on Family Policy Matters.
I am very happy to be here. Thanks for having me.
Well, we really appreciate your time. As we begin, I just want to jump right into your excellent book, which examines seven myths about marijuana that are prevalent in our society. The first myth that you cover is that marijuana is generally harmless and non-addictive. We hear this claim more and more frequently today than ever before, and not just from marijuana advocacy groups. If you would, Doctor, give us some specific examples of why marijuana is not only addictive, but that it is extremely dangerous.
Well, it's a great question. You know, a lot of people think that addiction has to mean that you're, you know, on the floor with a needle sticking out of your arm and you're having violent shakes and need to go to the hospital. In reality, addiction simply means your brain remembers the reward it had from doing something and it wants to do it again, regardless of the consequences. And it wants to do it over and over and over. And that is exactly what we see with some marijuana users. You know, I'm not here to say that every single user is going to have an addiction problem or a lot of problems, but the issue is the earlier you start, and these days kids are starting early, especially with the mixed messages they're getting, the more likely you are to damage your brain and become addicted. One in four 14-year-olds who try marijuana will become addicted. One in six 16-year-olds will become addicted. If you start when you're an adult, which is much rarer these days than it used to be, the chances are a lot lower, something like one in 10. So, you know, clearly it's a problem for some people. I'm not saying it's a problem for everybody. However, there are, you know, it does interfere with the brain's reward mechanism, the brain's circuitry, and it can be a major issue for some people. Unfortunately, the messages today are that, you know, it's totally harmless, it's a plant, and, you know, how bad can it be? Today's marijuana is so much stronger than it used to be. It's something 4 to 10 times stronger, depending on where you are, even more than that in many places like Colorado and California. And so I think a lot of people have kind of a misconception based on maybe 40 years ago when they experimented with it. You know, this is not your Woodstock weed.
Well, what has led to that increase in the potency of marijuana that we see today versus what we may have seen back in the 60s?
Well, first of all, we've just become a lot better at agriculture. I mean, selective breeding techniques are so much better than they used to be. And frankly, back in the 60s, you would want Mexican marijuana because that is the kind of marijuana that actually, you know, was stronger. These days, if you're a marijuana user and you want strong marijuana, you don't want Mexican. You want U.S. grown because we've done a much better job at the with the indoor grows, which, you know, all kinds of, by the way, pesticides and molds have been found on those. We've also done a great job with outdoor growing. And so, you know, we've learned to increase the potency. Remember, the potency comes from one molecule, one component in marijuana. That's called THC. And THC, we've learned to increase that component, and therefore we've learned to increase the potency.
Well, that's interesting. And I think that's important for our listeners to understand that the drug that we're talking about today is much more potent than what was typically available and used in prior decades. Dr. Sabet, another common myth that we hear from advocates of medical marijuana here in North Carolina, those that are proposing and pushing legislation in our General Assembly, is that marijuana is, quote, a legitimate medicine. Now, you address this claim in your book with a sort of a no, yes, and maybe response, but you include important distinctions. Explain that for us, if you would. How do you answer this question?
Well, you answer it the same way you would answer the question, is opiate a medicine? Opium is not smoked. We don't smoke opium to get the effects of morphine, right? But we do have powerful, important medicines that come from opium. Same thing is with marijuana. Although we don't have yet the evidence like we do with morphine, so it's not the exact comparison, but the analogy is similar. We can derive medical components from marijuana, and we should do the research. I think we should definitely do the research. I don't think that every single person who says that they're getting relief is lying. However, in absolutely no stretch of the imagination does it meet the criteria for medicine today. We don't smoke medicines, which is generally how medical marijuana is used, and because we can't dose a smoked plant. There's no way to do that. And so what we really need to do is do the research, and if it's found to have medical purposes, we should have them available at a pharmacy and from your doctor. Unfortunately, you know, people have made this exception with marijuana and said, you know, we're not going to have it at a pharmacy. We're not going to have it so you can get a real prescription. What instead we're going to have you do is go to a store around the corner in the bad part of town and talk to somebody with zero medical experience who's going to sell you something that has had no quality control that he's going to tell you to smoke. Now that's ridiculous. That's not medicine, but you know, our concept has been totally turned around. And it comes back to the movement to legalize marijuana. This has been legitimized day one with the legalization advocates essentially saying that if we can change the face of marijuana from the lazy 30-year-old to the ailing 80-year-old, we'll win the debate. And that's exactly what they've done. They've changed it so that now the face of marijuana is the ailing 80-year-old. And that's been very smart for them. Unfortunately, it has been deceptive, and it also, frankly, I think it has the effect of actually doing less research on marijuana than should be done, because it's by most scientific organizations, they kind of see medical marijuana as a ruse for legalization. So it sort of had a double bad effect, I think.
Well, we have certainly argued that exact thing here in North Carolina, that the push for medical marijuana is really just, and pardon the pun, but really just a smokescreen for full legalization for recreational use. How have you seen this approach utilized in the various states that have not only approved marijuana for recreational use, but also for medical marijuana or for medical use? And in the states that have approved it for medical use but not recreational use, do you see continued efforts of the proponents of marijuana legalization coming back and pushing over and over and over again for broader legalization?
Well, absolutely. They start with medical because that's kind of the way to loosen the tap, so to speak, and then they go to they go to full legalization after that. And that's how it's happened in every single state. I mean, you hear for years, no, this is only about getting it to people who are really ill. And then a couple years later, those same people come back and say, well, you know what? We've had that for a few years. Let's go to full legalization now. It's always how it goes. That's the playbook. And, you know, the reality is less than 2% of medical marijuana holders throughout the country have cancer, HIV, glaucoma, multiple sclerosis, etc. And so if this was really about those dying of cancer, you know, we might have to say, well, we have some compassion, and if this is the only thing that they bring some relief and they're dying in 6 months, then, you know, we're not going to make hay out of it. The reality is over 98% of this has nothing to do with those chronic terminal conditions. In reality, it's just another excuse to smoke marijuana. And we've seen this state after state where they introduce medical first and then go to full legalization.
Well, Dr. Sabetta, another myth that you tackle in the book, and this is something that we often hear as well, is the comparison between marijuana and alcohol and tobacco, which of course are legal products. First, isn't marijuana more dangerous in terms of its harm to young people than alcohol and tobacco? And secondly, what lessons can we learn from the tobacco and alcohol industries when it comes to the push to legalize marijuana?
Well, every drug has different effects, and I really don't think that the comparison actually makes sense on any level. That would, you know, my analogy for that comparison between alcohol, tobacco, and marijuana is sort of like telling a young person, do you want to jump out of the 8th story floor, the 12th story, or the 20th story? Obviously the 8th story might be better than the 20th story, but at the end of the day, they have the same result. You don't want that young person to do any of it. And that's exactly how I see alcohol, cigarettes, and marijuana. They're all bad for young people. They interfere with the brain. Of course, we do know that with tobacco, you don't get intoxicated from it. You don't get high. So you can drive a car and smoke a cigarette. You will not be psychoactive, intoxicated. Your brain will not be, you know, changed from that, from an intoxication standpoint. So there are some differences. Alcohol also, we know that with regards to intelligence and things like that, alcohol does not have the same effect as marijuana. Marijuana is worse. But on other levels, alcohol is worse. So, you know, again, I just think it's a false comparison, but it's something that the legalizers have used a lot because they are trying to appeal to our sense of, frankly, consistency. You know, we want everything to be consistent and perfect as humans, and so we say, well, if alcohol is harmful and it's legal, shouldn't other things that are harmful also be legal? Unfortunately, that's a terrible argument because in reality, the legalization of alcohol has been a destructive public health policy. I mean, nobody can say that it hasn't been. It doesn't mean you want to go back to prohibition. I mean, that's a different question entirely. But from a public health point of view, you know, the only reason alcohol is legal, frankly, is because it's been around since before the Old Testament. I mean, 5,000 years plus, it's been used in Western culture. That's not the same with marijuana in terms of the mainstream impact. So, you know, I just think it's a false comparison, but people bring it up a lot.
Well, one of the most powerful points you make in your book is that legalizing marijuana will ultimately create a new generation of heavy marijuana users. As you point out, an industry can't be built on just casual users. It really is dependent upon heavy users. How is marijuana being marketed in states like Colorado and Washington, where recreational use is legal, that is exacerbating this problem of the development of heavy users?
Well, this is where I think is the most powerful argument against legalization, and that is we are essentially creating the next big tobacco in front of our eyes. And we don't see it like that because marijuana has always been, you know, underground. It's always been the counterculture. It's never been the mainstream. Once it becomes more mainstream and normalized, you then have a massive corporate industry, frankly, just like you do the pharmaceutical industry, just like you do the alcohol industry and the tobacco industry. And I think the best analogy actually is the tobacco industry, because you now have actors in the marijuana business, medical or otherwise, who their only goal is to make money. And as you said, the only way to make money in an addictive business is to encourage a lot of people to use in a very heavy, irresponsible way. Even when you're telling them to use responsibly, you know, in tobacco, they always would say, well, we're not really targeting kids, and we just want people, adults, to use, you know, occasionally. If that were the case, they would have made no money. I mean, they don't make money off of somebody smoking once a year on their birthday. They make money off of that person smoking a pack a day, and they have to advertise and promote as such, and you have to start young, because if you're going to smoke a pack a day for the rest of your life, you're probably going to start young. You're not going to, I think very few of us know smokers who are battling smoking and tobacco addiction who started when they were 30. You know, that is not common. You start when you're 15 or younger. And with marijuana, we're seeing the exact same thing. There's a massive new corporate industry that has started. And I think we need to spread the word about that more than anything else, because I think that's the most surprising thing out of everything. Is that this is not about, you know, hippies singing kumbaya, you know, peace, love, and understanding. This is about massive corporate entities with huge hedge funds, funding mechanisms, and Wall Street folks who are really trying to become the next billionaires with this.
Well, Dr. Sabetta, unfortunately, we're just about out of time for this week, but I want to give you an opportunity to let our listeners know where they can go to learn more about your excellent book and to get a copy of your book, Reefer Sanity.
Absolutely. Well, they can go on Amazon and look up Reefer Sanity, Seven Great Myths About Marijuana. They can also go to the book website, which is just reefersanity.net. My own website with all kinds of articles is simply my name, kevinsabet.com. And then we have our website of the organization that we started, SAM, and that's learnaboutsam.org. So they can read all about the science there as well.
Dr. Kevin Sabet, I want to thank you so much for taking time out of your very busy schedule to join us and to share this really insightful information on Family Policy Matters.
Absolutely, John. Thank you so much for having me, and I hope we can. Your listeners are going to take advantage of the information and join us in our cause.
Family Family Policy Matters is an information and analysis feature of the North Carolina Family Policy Council. Join us weekly for discussion on policy issues affecting the family. If you have questions or comments, please contact us at 919-807-0800 or visit our website at ncfamily.org.